Hello, and welcome to the Architectette podcast. I'm your host, Caitlin Brady. Architectette is a podcast that illuminates the lesser heard stories of women plus in architecture and related fields. On today's episode of Architectette, we feature a conversation with Julianne Peters. Julianne is an interior designer at Hellyer Lewis Smith, founder of Design Success Network, and is also a multi-term leader of her local IIDA chapter, which is actually a pretty robust chapter because it includes Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. Julianne and I first connected in Philadelphia years ago through IIDA and AIA, so this conversation was a great opportunity to reconnect and talk about all of her growth. On today's episode, we talk about Julianne's early career experiences and how she navigated challenges during the pandemic, the roles and responsibilities of her current position, and the challenge of taking and passing the NCIDQ exams. And if you're not familiar, NCIDQ exams are basically the AREs, but for interior designers. We talk about the importance of legislation, both on a national and state level, to protect the title of interior designer, the ability to design drawings, and also what advocacy efforts are happening in various states to achieve recognition. Next, Julianne talks about her extensive volunteerism with professional organizations like IIDA and ASID, and she reflects on the benefits of her involvement, which extend far beyond the workplace. We finish with Julianne's founder story. We talk about the idea for Design Success Network and how she's trying to ease the burden of the NCIDQ exams by establishing a free online community with study resources and tutoring to help support designers both preparing for the exams, but also seeking professional development. If you're interested to learn more about Julianne and the Design Success Network, make sure to check out our show notes. While you're there, you can also share this episode with a friend or colleague, help us grow by leaving a rating or review, and you can also check us out on social media at Architectette, and you can also subscribe to our newsletter at architectette.com. That's architect, E-T-T-E.com. Enjoy this episode. I'd like to welcome our very first interior design guest, Julianne Peters. Welcome, Julianne.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Caitlin.
And so we know each other from Philadelphia. I don't recall the exact first time that we met, probably at an industry event, but I've been following along on LinkedIn for quite some time, and you're very involved and very active in a lot of the interior design world. And so I've always appreciated kind of following along with that journey and seeing what you're up to. So now we can share that with our listeners today.
Absolutely.
And so you are an interior designer that started at what used to be Philly U, but is now Jefferson University. Can you talk about what led you to choose that academic program?
So I was actually looking for architecture programs when I was in high school. I had only ever wanted to be an architect, or what I thought architecture was. I was like obsessively drawing plans and maps in grade school. And my mom was like, "You're getting in trouble for this. So we should figure out, like, what are you obsessing over and how could you turn that into a career?" So I knew that architecture was what I wanted to do, or something within that realm. I was graduating high school in 2009. So as I was applying to colleges in fall of 2008, the 2008 housing crisis happened. So I was looking around in my little, you know, naive 17-year-old brain. I was like, no one's going to build a building ever again. So I thought more interior design, more adaptive reuse. And from there, had applied to Philadelphia University's architecture program and began looking at interior design programs as well. Philadelphia University's interior design program was very architecturally focused, mm-hmm. and it looked very practical. The kind of work that was coming out of there that, you know, I was shown as someone, you know, at an open house, like, it was full construction documentation plans. The renderings were of all different kinds of programmatic spaces. So I was really drawn to that. I'm also originally from the Philadelphia area. I do have family still in the suburbs here. So I sort of swam upstream. I wanted to go to a big city, especially being interested in something like architecture. And a city like Philadelphia, I mean, there's old, there's new, there's an international airport, so you can get anywhere in the world. It's, mm-hmm. you know, I've chosen to stay. I think it's the best place in the world.
Yeah, I think Philadelphia doesn't have, maybe when others look at it on paper, it's like, oh, don't want to go there. But then once you get in, it is such a cultural and architectural gem, and the communities are so vibrant, and there's like a lot of just people really care about the people that are around them and the spaces that are around them. And it's really interesting to contribute to that at a design level into a community that cares so much.
Yeah, there's a lot of heart here within mm-hmm. the design community and just within people, like people who live here. So it's definitely a special place to be.
And so was there any type of co-op element when you were at Philly U, or did you just start working once you graduated?
There was not any like formal co-op that some other universities have. There was, you know, internship for credit that you could do, but I kind of looked at that and I was like, why do I want to pay for the credits to have an internship? So I just started looking for gigs, whether it was like a part-time thing, an internship. I started my sophomore year trying to find this, and some of my professors were like, you're a little too early in your career, you know, and you're too early in school. But I ended up through Craigslist, talk about a throwback. Mm-hmm. I found a assistant designer position at a furniture showroom in Old City. So I actually worked there for a summer. That's where I started learning like all the names of all the different brands of furniture. It was definitely geared very residential, but they still, you know, did work for the occasional like boutique commercial client. And, you know, I would manage the showroom on the weekends. I would help them develop presentations to go into firms or design offices. And, you know, it was the first time I ever sat in an Eames lounge chair. And I just like have vivid memories of that. It was, you know, incredible. So I learned a lot there. I had another part-time job. I guess I never really had a formal internship, but I had another part-time job working at a firm. And I got that connection through someone I was nannying for in college. Like, you just got to be on and ready to network at all times. So this person was like, you know, I have a relative who's opening up a like startup branch in Philly. And I ended up working there full time for a summer and then part time throughout the school year. They wanted me to stay on after I'd graduated, but I just, you know, wanted to see what else was out there and ended up applying to Hellyer Lewis Smith, where I work now, which is in Center City, Philadelphia. I actually found the job listing on the AIA website. Like, I was just applying everywhere. And I came in and they were an architecture firm that did corporate interiors. I was like, oh, this, I loved the corporate project I did in school. I really enjoyed, you know, the personalities of the people that I met when I came in to interview. And they sent me an offer the next day that I just could not refuse. So I took it. I graduated on a Saturday, started working on a Monday, didn't take any time off.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I've been there ever since. I've been there since 2015. We do corporate interiors for large insurance and financial clients across North America. And we have done work internationally. And, you know, it's wherever our clients want us to go is where we go. Everything we do is based off master service agreements. So we have few clients, but we get to know them very well. And we can take them through the process from looking at real estate all the way through the design and construction phases. So they're very sophisticated and we have long-standing relationships with them. I'm managing about a dozen projects now, and most of them are with the same person at the same client. So it's nice to be able to build those like relationships as well. Mm-hmm.
And how has your client been affected or your clients been affected by the pandemic? I think corporate interiors, a lot of people were designing beautiful spaces, encouraging employees to come in, taking advantage of amenities. And I used to work in San Francisco and we worked for a lot of tech client offices, designed those. And it's very different now because there was that everyone worked from home and then there was the hybrid. And now I think a lot of like calls back to the office are going out. But how are owners approaching their spaces in terms of design or downsizing or efficiencies?
Yeah. So for our clients, we do a mix of leased spaces and owned spaces. We also do call centers, sales offices, and retail bank branches. So all of those kind of have their own unique challenges. As far as the sales centers and like call centers, those kind of like headquarters offices, a lot of those are going with flex seating, hoteling, free address, those kinds of things. And we were doing a little bit of that even before the pandemic, definitely trending in terms of just like saving money on your square footage. So even now though, the smaller sales offices that we're doing, they will have flex seating. So it'll be insurance agents who will work from home or go visit clients. So they don't actually need that dedicated seat. You know, we really tailor it per the end user. Our clients are really good about speaking to the local agents that will be running out of that office and seeing what they need. So sometimes we still have, you know, offices that we design that have a lot of dedicated spaces, but it's definitely going more and more flexible as time goes on. During the, you know, lockdown sort of era of the pandemic itself, a lot of work stopped because our clients didn't want us to travel because of health risks. They also, you know, there was a time period where, depending on what state, you know, we do work all across North America, depending on where it was, there were different regulations of could the construction workers even be on site. And it was a very complicated thing to deal with. I'm very grateful for the stability of the work that we have. So my firm didn't actually have to lay anyone off, which was really incredible. And, you know, even when we were going back into the office, they were very clear with us. Like, we had one of our engineers that we contract with for a bunch of our projects actually did like a full HVAC assessment of our office for us. The firm partners, you know, gave that to us. We still now have the option to work from home occasionally, which is great with flexibility. And, you know, if you are feeling under the weather, things like that, but they've really thought of us as people in regards to coming back. So I don't quite have flex seating at the office because I've got a pile of samples that I need to have at my desk. But our clients are doing that.
Okay. Yeah, it's harder for interior designers, especially because you're getting such a quantity of samples and options, and then you have to hold on to those for a period of time, and you don't necessarily want to put them back in the library. Yeah. They're sitting at your desk with you.
Yeah. And even in the library, like post-pandemic, because during lockdown and when, you know, we were not in the office as much, we couldn't have reps come in to update things. Mm-hmm. But life cycle of materials still goes on. So we actually just had a rep come in this week and we filled an entire trash can with things that have been discontinued because someone just hadn't been there in a while. So yeah, it's definitely, I've got many bins full of tiles and things at my desk.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's part of the job, right?
Yeah.
So how many people work at your office right now?
There's about 12 of us. It's a mix of architects and interior designers, but we all are given the same responsibilities. So as a firm associate, I run my own projects and can speak with clients on behalf of the firm. Mm-hmm. We have folks who are, you know, registered architects who sign and seal the drawings, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're the ones following it through permit submission. I'm the one who gets to wrangle with the local authority having jurisdiction when they, you know, disagree with something we've done on the plan, if it's my project. So when it came to things like taking the NCIDQ for interior designers, which has, you know, its entire contract section, contracts, permits, you know, at my firm, everyone does everything. During the pandemic, when we shifted for one of our clients to do a lot of bank branches, they actually had acquired another smaller bank that had several branches that they wanted to bring up to their branding standards, including the exterior. So I was learning exterior cladding details during lockdown, which, you know, when you're not there in studio to have that like person-to-person mentorship can be really tough. But, you know, I was reaching out to the architects, making sure I was, you know, a section is a section. I just need to understand how these pieces fit together because it's a little bit different. So, you know, it became a whole new adventure of being able to go on site and being like, I built that.
Oh, that's awesome. And I know it's kind of a controversial topic depending on who you ask, but do you think that interior designers should be able to stamp drawings? Obviously not with an architecture stamp, but do you think that there could be like an interior design stamp that would be equal to that of an architect?
So this already exists in several states. The CIDQ, which is the Center for Interior Design Qualification website, tracks a lot of this. And I have been active with the coalition that is in my state of Pennsylvania. And right now in Pennsylvania, we have no legislation that protects our profession in one way or another. When it comes to legislation, where it's like, you know, signing and sealing drawings, like you're saying, there's other types or like levels. New Jersey, for example, has something called a Title Act. So you cannot call yourself a certified interior designer unless you've passed the examination, the NCIDQ, and have registered with the state. In Texas, for example, as an interior designer who registers with the state after having passed your exams, you can sign and seal drawings. You get your own little seal. You can submit things for permit. I think that it's just the future of the industry. We have a very good knowledge base in what we do. We're not trying to, you know, do ground up construction on our own. But when it comes to the inside of a space and affecting life safety, we can also read code. We can also interpret it. And, you know, we absolutely, I think, have the right to be able to submit our own projects as opposed to paying an architect. If, you know, let's say you, at my firm, we have architects that we work with who, you know, are also within the firm. So we're always talking about the drawings together. And it's a very collaborative process across our entire studio. But let's say that you are going out on your own and you're like a one-person design firm and you want to, you know, be able to make some alterations to a space And then you have to go pay an architect to sign and seal those drawings. And I've heard many stories where the architects aren't even looking at them. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's the future of the profession. Interior design is relatively young compared to architecture because it was sort of, it's like a offshoot. But as things are growing, and especially as the needs of the built environment are growing, there's going to be more specialization. And, you know, sometimes it just makes sense to focus on the interiors, and being able to have the power and control over your own work, I think, is really important.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that the protection of using the word interior designer or the title interior designer is also essential?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because you have a lot of people will watch HGTV and they see what I like to call paint and pillows. That is decoration, which is a whole thing in its own right. I would be a terrible interior decorator, if I'm being honest. I'm in corporate interiors because I love branding. Mm-hmm. But if I was to try and just be a decorator, it would be, you know, it's not my wheelhouse. And what decorators do is also not as intense as design. Our profession in other countries in the world is actually called interior architecture. And there are degree mm-hmm. programs across the world and some in the States that are called interior architecture. So I think it's only fair, it's only right, and we are more than qualified to be able to handle what's in our realm of competence.
Yeah, the HGTV comment reminded me of Trading Spaces, watching Hildy just ruin a space with straw on the walls or whatever. I would say that would be more decoration, where interior design is a lot of a heavier lift, and architecture too kind of translates more to the exterior, but also has that interior presence. There's a lot of overlap,
absolutely,
I think, with a lot of these professions. So that being said, we've talked a little bit about NCIDQ. I know also we'll talk about IIDA. Can you just give a brief synopsis of what are these organizations and how are they important to your profession?
Sure. So I'll start with IIDA, which stands for the International Interior Design Association. Mm-hmm. That is a professional association for interior designers that specifically focuses on like the commercial and contract world. There are absolutely still residential designers that are a part of it. There are, you know, local design awards that recognize residential design, but it, as founding core principle, is for promoting and elevating interior design within the contract space. There are also other numerous organizations, but sort of the two big ones when it comes to interior design are IIDA, and then there's also ASID, which is the American Society of Interior Designers. Both of those organizations are nationwide. IIDA extends beyond that. And they both locally at chapter levels do a lot of different things. I was involved in my local IIDA chapter since I was a student. I was a student member, and I actually became co-president of my IIDA campus center. After mm-hmm. graduation, I moved on to do event planning at the local level here in Philly, in the Philadelphia City Center. I became City Center Director of Philly, and then from there became chapter president. And how IIDA is structured, the chapter that I was president of, it's a mouthful, was Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware chapter.
Okay.
So I oversaw programming and events for all three states. We did things for students, current interior design students, as well as primary education level K-12, you know, teaching them what interior design is and how it's different from decoration. We also did work with professional development. We do fundraising for different efforts, including for legislative efforts. But we've also done work with groups like Habitat for Humanity, with the ACE Mentor Program. We also focus on offering CEUs to members and to the general community. When I was Philadelphia City Center Director, this was probably, I think it was like 2017, 18, I was hosting at least one event a month in Philadelphia. It was like pre-pandemic peak, like everyone's going out, everyone's doing things. And some of those events would be a showroom hosted CEU, just come, you know, get a little nibble, get a little drink, learn a little bit. And then other of those events were like six-figure design award galas. So it really ran the gamut. And then 2019, I had stepped into the role as president-elect and sort of spent, you know, the IIDA calendar year goes June to June. So June 2019 to June 2020, I was, you know, coming up with all my ideas of what I wanted to do. And then pandemic happened. So I stepped into the role as president, and a lot of our board members were getting laid off or were getting sick or had sick family members. I was fortunate enough to have a stable job, to be healthy, always grateful for both of those things. And, you know, I just took everything on. I was like, okay, our VP of communications is sick. and everyone was laid off at her firm but her. Ugh. I will take care of the social media. And I taught myself how to social media market. So it was definitely an interesting time. You know, we pivoted to doing a lot online. How can we, you know, focus on keeping people together and connected, things like that. And other organizations, everyone sort of had the same struggle. A lot of us came together in my area in Philadelphia, IIDA, ASID, and NEWH, which is a group that focuses on hospitality, not just design, but, you know, the entire hospitality industry. The three of us came together to do like virtual events and things like that. And, you know, there's lots of cross collaboration. So it was definitely a crazy time. Coming out of that, actually, while I was still president, I ended up doing 2 years back to back because people were a lot more just aware of their bandwidth. And, you know, everyone was kind of burnt out and depressed, and signing up to do something like being the president of a tri-state organization is a lot. So I said, yes, I will, you know, run a victory lap. I'll do another year. And while I did that, I worked with our VP of professional development at the time to create an NCIDQ study series. In the past, our chapter had done, you know, like study retreat weekends where we'd hire someone to come in and like talk about the exam, but nothing had really been consistent. And with something, you know, with, I mean, a lot of events and, you know, building any kind of branding, I'm sure, you know, it's the same thing like what you do with a podcast. You have to be consistent. You have to put out, you know, episodes or events in a certain timeline. So I said, we need to come up with a way to have a consistent NCIDQ offering because people want this. And I think, you know, the NCIDQ is important for our profession because it sort of gives us that stamp of approval that we have a certain level of knowledge. I helped co-create with Jenna Lynn Sachs a NCIDQ study series where we met once a month on Zoom. And everyone who signed up for this also got a subscription to Q Practice. Q Practice is the leader in the space for NCIDQ study materials. I, at that point in time, was helping to run this study program and had also been several years out of school. So I said, I'm going to rip off the Band-Aid. I'm going to take all three exams at once, and we'll just see what happens. Knock on wood, somehow managed to pass all three of them. It's a process that I would not recommend to other people.
You did them all at one time, at one sitting?
Yeah, so the way, not at one sitting. So the way the NCIDQ works, it's actually a little bit different than the AREs. It's only offered twice a year, every April and October. There is a rolling clock where you have to complete all three exams with a passing score within 5 years. And yeah, you only have that 1 month chunk of time, and then you have to go on and wait, you know, 6 months to do it again. So I scheduled my three exams. There, two of them are multiple choice. One is like you're working with working drawings. It used to be hand drafting up until a couple of years ago. Yeah. And I was like,
oh, wow,
not doing that. I use that as a procrastination excuse. I was like, I'm not, you know, buying a drawing board again. I've got Trace, but like, I'm not doing this.
That hand drawing, would you have taken it at like a special testing center, or you're bringing a drafting board into Prometric or something?
I'm not entirely sure how that worked because it was something that I was just so against doing.
Yeah.
And the way it works now is that they've actually created like a software for the exams where you like drag and drop the labels on drawings, whether it's like you're labeling a section or you're putting in clearances and things. So it is fair in the sense that if you've never used Revit, you don't have to use Revit for this exam.
Sure.
So each of those exams are, you know, several hours. I spaced them out. So I was doing one a week, and I started at the beginning of the month, one a week. And I said, you know, if for whatever reason something comes up and I get, you know, like I need more time to study, I can always pay to reschedule the exam within that month, but it ended up being all right. I went through it. For the two multiple choice, they do email you a preliminary score. Like I literally got it in the elevator as I was leaving the building. And
oh,
I would like,
gosh.
I went out to the park and I sat down. And I was like, okay, I'm going to open it. And then for the practicum section, because they actually go through like a review process with, you know, actual people, I had to wait for that one. But yeah, I passed all three of them in October 2021.
Congrats.
Thank you. My girlfriend tells me that I'm not allowed to tell anyone else to do that because I was very focused and not the best person to live with at that period in time.
Okay. Okay.
But it's, you know, I know many people who have struggled taking it and taking them over and over again. And it's still important. And I happened to be a good test taker who was also running an NCIDQ test course with someone who was certified and, you know, had support around me and a girlfriend putting up with me. So it worked out and I managed to pass all of them.
What do they cover in terms of subject material? Is it everything in terms of like code and specifications and kind of layouts. You mentioned some drawings, but does it go into like light fixtures or architecture covered welding at one point too? I'm like, I've never specified a weld before, but I had to know that for the exam.
Yeah, it really covers everything. So the first exam that most students who graduate from an accredited interior design program, the group that accredits interior design schools is called CIDA, C-I-D-A, the Council for Interior Design Accreditation. The moment you graduate, you can take the fundamentals exam, IDFX, okay. Interior Design Fundamental Exam. And that one, it's very much what it says. Some of the questions are like, what does this drawing symbol mean? And then some of the questions, you know, do start to dig deeper. When you get into IDPX, which is the professional exam, and then the practicum, which is the one with the drawings, you're diving into ethics, you're diving into contracts. Yes, you need to know like light fixtures, for example. There was a question on, you know, my exam where you had to refer to a lighting specification schedule and put in the appropriate light fixtures on a plan, like know which mm-hmm. one to specify. And is it ceiling mounted? Is it wall mounted? You know, different things like that. You have to know a lot about ADA, a lot about code. The NCIDQ exam in its current iteration, just like the AREs, they update it over time. Its current iteration goes based off the 2018 IBC. And they, in the practicum, they have like excerpts of it for you to reference. In the other two exams, you just have to have the specific sections. They give you, you know, a list of sections that are potential content for the exam. You just sort of have to have the general understanding of those memorized. They will ask questions about calculating occupancy. They will ask questions about, you know, appropriate egress widths. They ask a lot of questions about exits and egress and all of those kinds of things. When I was taking the exam, I knew from my work that there were certain things that I knew like the back of my hand. BOMA measurements, mm-hmm. I know it like the back of my hand. I have to do that for every project. I know exactly how that works. But because I work for larger clients, a lot of the finishes they have are standardized. So if I'm picking an upholstery, it's already one of three pre-approved things, for example. So I knew I needed to take extra time to focus on different material testing, all the different flammability tests and durability tests and those kinds of things were things that I just didn't have enough working experience with. It was things I learned in school. They're definitely things that come up when I'm working on like specialty areas in projects. Mm-hmm. But it's not my day to day. So I knew that I needed to focus on that kind of content. They even break it down to understanding, you know, adjacencies between spaces. Like they will give you a bubble diagram, mm-hmm. throwback. They'll give you a bubble diagram and have you answer questions that prove that you know how to read that. You know, there are questions about appropriate placements of smoke detectors and exit signs. So they even dig into the NFPA. It's very comprehensive. And if you, you know, are doing, it's a little bit, in my opinion, geared a little bit more towards like the contract interior design world. There are residential questions on there, mm-hmm. but a lot of those pertain to like multifamily and accessibility. But it covers everything. It covers everything. There was a lot of ethical questions and understanding like who has what responsibility based on contracts, things like that, where again, like I, as a project manager at my firm, do contracts. So I was aware of, you know, when questions would come up, who takes, you know, the responsibility for different parts of the project where mm-hmm. something goes wrong, understanding, you know, what kind of kickbacks are not okay from like sales reps and things like that.
And so these tests cover a ton of information, but
absolutely,
if your chapter isn't offering a study session like the like your Philadelphia and New Jersey and Delaware chapter was offering, then maybe it's hard to find resources online that are reliable, that cater to the specific needs and questions that you have about the different material. If there's gaps in your knowledge, I think it seems like you were very self-aware of, this is what I know, this is what I don't know. I'm going to really focus on what I don't know to make sure that that information is up to date with everything else I need. And you had the resources to do it. But for someone who doesn't have those resources, can you tell me about the Design Success Network?
Yeah. So Design Success Network is a company that I've started initially to fill a hole in the NCIDQ study sector. When I was doing the IIDA study group, we were running it virtually. So we actually had people from other states reaching out to us because we published it on the headquarters website. And we had someone from Tennessee. We had someone from I think like Ohio or something, you know, different people joining us. Mm-hmm. And what I also saw through Q Practice was they had a ton of content. It was fantastic. I was able to go through different practice exams and ask questions through like their online forum and things. And then this past summer, I taught NCIDQ exam prep for a company that was called ID Conquer in summer 2023. And that company has since closed down. And I really enjoyed being able to like one-on-one, like talk to people. It was all online, but it was still a little bit more than just reading a book or a little bit more than just being able to talk in a forum. So I was sort of taking all those experiences. And in my time also as an NCIDQ ambassador, anyone who is NCIDQ certified can sort of sign up to be on the website and people reach out to me if they have questions about the exam. I go and I talk to universities, things like that. I just kept getting a lot of the same kind of questions. It's the exam is so expensive. Studying for it is so expensive. I really wish I had a study group, things like that. So I've identified this need where if you work at a small firm like I do and no one else is studying for the exam, or if you are in rural middle America and don't have access to your local chapter, or if you're a student who's just graduated and can't afford the hundreds of dollars that it costs to sign mm-hmm. up for some of these things, there really isn't an option for you. You can read the book and you're just kind of on your own. So mm-hmm. Design Success Network is first and foremost an online community that is completely free for interior designers to gather and talk about professional development. So mm-hmm. my, you know, springboard for this was thinking about the NCIDQ, but there are other exams that we take like LEED and WELL, where there are study materials out there for them, but what if you don't have anyone else to talk to about that? Mm-hmm. And honestly, with the study course that, you know, I did through my IIDA chapter, some of the days we just spent a lot of time talking about mental health. And like, mm-hmm. that's not something that you can necessarily read in a book. So just having an online community to be able to make those connections. And then through that, we offer tutoring. So I had people reaching out to me asking for this from me as an individual. And I think that there are so many talented people across the board that have knowledge to share about either an exam or, you know, potentially even expanding it to like career coaching and things like that, that thanks to the beauty of the internet, especially how much we all learned how to use it to connect, you know, through the pandemic, we can now talk to one another. So it's a free online Discord server. Discord is a very dense but manageable application. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other online communities use it too. There's a lot of like architecture YouTubers who have online communities that way. So that's just a place where everyone can talk. And then you can also reach out to Design Success Network to buy tutoring hours. So if you have, if you're like me and you're like, I know this topic, but I really struggle with drapery calculations and carpet calculations, which are also things that I struggled with, you could contract, buy, you know, an hour of tutoring time. Send me your question. I'll look at it ahead of time. And then you have one-on-one attention from me to be able to work through this problem, to make sure that you really understand it, to ask me to explain it to you in a different way. Where if you're reading it in a book, you can't say like, hey, Mr. Ballast, can you, you know, explain this to me?
Exactly.
You know, or give me another example. There's such limited resources. We also have downloadable content that is a la carte. So instead of having to pay hundreds of dollars when you only really are struggling with a topic or two, or maybe you're only studying for one exam and you're early on in your journey and you're just dipping your toe in, you can purchase just a worksheet on understanding contracts or just a set of practice problems for identifying, you know, measuring for BOMA measurements or things like that. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to make this as accessible for people of all locations, all ages, all economic statuses, to be able to take this exam, because it's, the exam itself is expensive. And unfortunately, I can't do anything about that. Maybe someday I'll be able to like offer scholarships or something to take the exam. Mm-hmm. But it's something that makes our profession stronger, just like how taking the exams for architects makes your profession stronger, just how passing the bar for lawyers makes that profession stronger. It shows that we have a certain level of understanding. Mm-hmm. And it also, you know, as more people understand what the NCIDQ is, then they will understand the interior designers that are qualified, you know, what exactly they know and what they're capable of, because there is just so much misinformation and misunderstanding out there.
Yeah, it's a level of competency of I have achieved this level because I have tested and I've been recognized and I'm also certified by the state and I have this kind of backing of being authentic and real rather than just kind of slapping a name on. Like, yeah, I watched HGTV. I watched the YouTube videos. I've done the, you know, interior design masterclass. It's like, no, you have the education, you have the work experience, you've taken the exams and you can, it's a level of trust that then clients can have in you because you've achieved that level.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so as we wrap up, I have a couple more questions. Back when you were talking about all of the leadership roles that you've had, both at when you were in university and then afterwards, do you think, I've attended a few lectures or conferences recently where they talk about getting involved in not just your job, but in the profession outside of your job, how there's so many benefits in terms of leadership development and networking, and just it takes your career to the next level. How has your experience impacted where you are today by getting outside of your 9 to 5 or your 8 to 7 or, you know, whatever it is?
Absolutely. So when I started at my firm, we're a small firm with very niche clients. So we're not, you know, submitting for the big awards. We're not pounding the pavement, trying to get, you know, RFPs and things like that. So I felt a little isolated from the community. Luckily, I stayed in the city where I went to school. So I had, you know, connections that way. But getting involved through IIDA, initially at just like a volunteer level, not even a volunteer leader level, gave me friends within the community. Like, it's so important to be able to talk to someone outside your workplace about things that are going on, whether it's trends, whether it's even talking about things, you know, as far as like workplace politics and just understanding how different firms work. Speaking to sales reps, like I have so many friends now that, and, you know, colleagues that are sales reps, and just understanding how their part of the world works, because they're IIDA members too. And the programming that I was, you know, helping to develop needed to serve them as well. But I will say, stepping into a leadership role and really getting concrete about my commitment there to these professional, you know, any professional organization, was one of the biggest, you know, sort of, you know, step ups that I was able to make in my career without realizing it. Because while, even though I was a young designer, I was not yet a project manager, I was able to manage projects through IIDA. I learned soft skills about how to, you know, do public speaking. I learned how to deal with people who are giving you money when they're upset. Because, you know, mistakes happen. And, you know, it's the same thing as like when a client's upset. Like, how do you handle that on the phone? When I got to the president level, I was doing profit and loss spreadsheets for our chapter. And I was able to come into work and say, like, I fundraised $80,000 for this event, you know, with a team of this many people. And my boss was like, really? Really?
It's like, could you do that for us, please? Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And I did actually take that, and I went out and I helped, you know, do some event planning for like a local ski club. I planned some trips for them. I had friends who wanted to start a nonprofit that was focused on teaching people how to surf. So I helped them with like fundraising and like learning how to brand things and that kind of stuff. So it gave me all of the soft skills that I would have needed to learn later as a project manager or as a firm associate or, you know, principal partner, whatever your firm structure is. I already had those skills when I was ready to step into the role, when I had the design knowledge. So it gave me such a leg up compared to other people who weren't getting involved. And I'm sure, you know, if I had also put myself back out there on the job market, I would have already had a reputation to be able to move into another firm who would know the caliber of work that I am capable of, at least on an organizational scale. You know, I've been at the same firm since I graduated college and I'm very happy there, but it definitely puts my name out there in a way that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. You know, it's still, even now when I attend some of these events that I'm no longer a part of organizing, people come up to me and say, thank you. Or they'll ask me like a question about another event. I still get text messages like, oh, I need to connect someone with so-and-so. Like, do you know who's in charge of this? And I'm like, I can figure it out. I don't necessarily know, but I can figure it out for you. So it gave me a huge network and so many soft skills that are things you don't learn in your firm and in school. And it's also, you know, the best way to make this profession that we all spend so much time in and care so much about, we can also make it a better place. Like, some of the events that we had when I was chapter president really focused on diversity and understanding. We had an incredible workshop series where we contracted with a group out of New York. This woman had left working in an architecture firm and specifically wanted to do DEI work within that realm. And she ran a workshop for us that had the attendees actually create actionable plans to go back to their workplace and make a difference. It wasn't just sit here and talk about it. It was like, we're going to do something. And that's the kind of thing that you can do through these professional associations, no matter how big or small they are. Even if it's just, maybe it's like your local chamber of commerce or Cornet or Crew. Like, there's so many things, and you get to meet like-minded people, you get to make a difference, and you get to grow as a person. Like, it definitely benefited me, but I think it benefited everyone else around me more.
I guess, oh my gosh, there's so many questions I could follow up from that. What are your favorite events, tips for students? But I think you kind of covered a lot of that in that response. My last question is, in 2023, we had an episode with the Emerging Architect Award winners, some past ones from AIADC. And one of the women was saying that she held a leadership role in the Emerging Architects Committee. And when she was looking to the future, she didn't want to just be known as the, like, 2019 Emerging Architects Committee chair. She's like, what is next? And so you've already been president. What is next for you? What are you looking forward to?
I think it's really going to be Design Success Network. This is something that, you know, my chapter president role was really strong in the tri-state area. And this is something that could reach beyond that. I would love to be able to connect with high school students who are trying to figure out where to go to college, to explain to them the difference between design and decoration and what's accredited and what's not. You know, I think that this is going to be absolutely my next, it's a very big undertaking that I'm going into, but the industry needs it. And I have a very deep passion for this sort of, I guess, like, education. You know, I'm definitely creating a network, but my passion is that I want all these people to learn things, because there's so much that we have to learn from one another. You know, I go back to student critiques at my alma mater and other schools in the city, and I learn from those students all the time, even if they're only sophomores, like, they still have something to teach me. So being able to bring all of us together in community is so important.
And so if people want to connect with you or follow or learn more about the Design Success Network, where can people find you?
Sure. So I'm on pretty much every social media as Julianne J. Peters. That's J-U-L-I-A-N-N-E. And Design Success Network is the exact same thing. Design Success Network on Instagram, on LinkedIn, designsuccessnetwork.com. I would absolutely love to talk more to any designers or even architects who are considering taking the exam, you know, interested in talking to students. I just love sharing so much about this, you know, industry that I love, and I'm excited to do more of that.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate you coming on this episode of Architect Debt and sharing with me. And I will link all of those in the show notes. So if people didn't get them and they go, oh, I didn't write it down, or I'm driving, they can check the show notes later and click those links. And hopefully they have some support when they're studying for their exams.
Awesome. Thank you so much for, you know, allowing me to also share that in addition to my own story. I really love what you're doing with this podcast. I think it's a very important lens to see our industry through.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Architect Debt. If you enjoyed the episode, don't forget to share it with your network, leave us a 5-star rating and review, and follow us on social media. Reach out to the podcast directly at architectet.com. That's architect, E-T-T-E.com. Join us in 2 weeks for our next episode. See you then.